All right. First of all, I do not apologize for this title. I know it's a bad, bad pun, but I just couldn't resist. And secondly, what I'm going to do today with this talk is actually sort of dive in at the end of what Michaela was talking about earlier and actually talk about this idea of creating successive generations of black hole mergers that can potentially populate any sort of mass gap that might be excluded by the pulsational pair instability. So going back just sort of to this broad picture that we've all been sort of duking out for the past few years, there's this sort of very broad idea that there's two general ways, right, of forming merging compact objects. You have isolated binary evolution, either through the common envelope or chemically homogeneous evolution, and you have dynamical formation, either through open clusters, globular clusters, nuclear star clusters, you know, pick a cluster. In reality, of course, there's a whole host of different formation channels, but most of them, typically speaking, fall into one of these two categories. The real question that we're interested in, right, is can we tell the difference? In order to do actual astrophysics with this, we have to be able to discriminate these populations, because we want to do all the fancy things that we've all been saying in our proposals, like doing gravitational wave population inference or understanding the evolution of massive stars. We have to actually figure out which of these formation channels are creating which events that we see. And so I'm going to give a very brief overview on just how sort of dynamical formation works in star clusters that are somewhat bigger than the ones that Michaela was talking about. So in open clusters, like Michaela was saying, typically your black hole binaries are formed through exchanges. You have a black hole main sequence binary, another black hole comes in, messes with it, and forms a double black hole. In larger star clusters, like say globular clusters, the picture is a little bit different. In that case, you don't even need a pre-existing binary. If I have two isolated objects, I can actually throw them at one another with a close enough paracenter passage that if there was a third interloping object nearby, which tends to happen in the cores of dense star clusters, you can actually dump some of that excess energy and angular momentum onto that third object and create a bound system. Now, once I've created this bound system, I've essentially created a giant black hole binary inside of a star cluster that's essentially acting like a giant target in a particle physics experiment. And in fact, if you're slightly insane, you can actually try to express this in terms of Feynman interaction diagrams. This is cute for a talk, but fundamentally useless. So in reality, the way we like to do this is with small and in-body integrations. So this is an extraction from one of the simulations that I've been doing. It's the exact same philosophy to the stuff that Michaela was showing. And essentially, when these interactions happen, you throw your black hole binary at an interloping star or black hole. It'll undergo many different closed passages, and eventually, a new binary will leave this encounter, characteristically with a shorter separation and a shorter orbital period than it came in with. This is what we call Hege's law. Typically, the hard binaries tend to harden and sacrifice some of their binding energy during every encounter. Now, when this happens, binary shrinks its semi-major axis, that binding energy is liberated into the recoil, it throws it out into the halo of the cluster, eventually dynamical friction brings it back into the center, and this process happens again and again until eventually, and this is what I was taught, and is that this black hole gets thrown out of the cluster where it'll eventually merge many giga-years later in the field. Now, this was the story that we've been saying for about 20 or 30 years at this point. I mean, this goes back to Sri Kulkarni, Sigerson, like 1993. And in fact, even if you go back 3 years ago on the KITP website, you can actually find this exact intro of this talk given in this exact room by me. And in fact, some of these people haven't even moved. Lars and Duncan are exactly where they are in the picture. Yeah, sorry. Duncan went through an exchange interaction. He's over there now. But roughly speaking, the system is chaotically shaken, but about where it was to begin with. Now, I threw this in here as a joke, obviously, but this joke does speak to an underlying truth, which is that despite a lot of updates we can make to this, despite a lot of fine-tuning to some of the initial conditions, the core of this, the physics that drives this binary formation, is all simple, well-understood gravitational dynamics. The reason this joke works is because it's based on simple in-body gravitational dynamics that hopefully has not changed between 2016 and now. One of the things that has changed is exactly where these black holes merge. So for a while, we thought that all of these black holes would predominantly get kicked out of the cluster, and then they would merge many giga-years later in the field of galaxies. This turns out to not actually be true. It turns out we were missing a key ingredient of the physics, which was actually gravitational wave emission from the binaries in the cluster and during these close encounters that I showed earlier. And you can think about this as a competition between two different timescales. You have your typical interaction timescale between binary and single objects, which roughly speaking scales is in sigma V. You can write that down for your typical binary in a cluster as the number density of other black holes times the semi-major axis squared times the velocity dispersion. And if I pick typical parameters for a binary that's just about to get kicked out of the cluster, it turns out that the typical interaction timescale between successive encounters is about 40 megayears. Contrast this to the gravitational wave merger timescale, which goes as the semi-major axis to the fourth power times this factor in eccentricity. And if I have a zero eccentricity, a circular binary, it's roughly going to take 150 gigayears to merge. So if I take the ratio between those two, right, my gravitational wave timescale is about 4,000 times longer than the binary single timescale, and this binary is going to get thrown out of the cluster. But of course, I've assumed, naively, that this binary is circular. And we know in dynamical encounters that that is actually false. Every time you leave one of those scattering encounters, you actually draw a new eccentricity from what's called the thermal distribution, literally just proportional to the eccentricity. So you are more likely to get binaries with higher eccentricities. And so if I plug in to this, if I include this term that compensates for the eccentricity, if I have even a binary with an eccentricity of 0.95, which is roughly 10% of the time that I leave a dynamical encounter, the ratio between these two timescales goes to 1. And so in that case, I have roughly a 50% chance of merging in the cluster and a 50% chance of getting ejected into the field. Now, this already carries with it some interesting implications. It turns out that because of this, you can actually produce binaries with significant eccentricities even in the LIGO band that can be measured. I'm not going to talk about that today. The key point of this is that roughly half of all binaries, it seems, merge inside of the clusters that they're formed in. And that turns out to have the really interesting implications that I'm going to talk about for the last 12 minutes or so. So I have this binary that is formed in the middle of a cluster. Roughly 1 out of 2 times, it's going to merge inside the cluster and create a new black hole with roughly twice the mass, give or take, and a spin of 0.7. Now, for the longest time, right, we thought that black holes formed from stellar collapse had near-extremal spins. Everything we observed from low-mass and high-mass X-ray binaries said that the Kerr parameters of black holes were roughly 1. And if I say what happens to this black hole merger, if I have two black holes with near-extremal spins merging, turns out you get a massive recoil kick from this encounter. And the reason is, if I have two black holes that have spins, the emission of gravitational waves is not spherically symmetric about the black hole binary. If the spins are oriented, in particular in this direction, so they're 45 degrees off the orbital angular momentum, I preferentially emit gravitational waves in a single direction. And in this particular instance, I can actually get a kick as high as 5,000 kilometers a second. Spinning black hole merges, its remnant gets a kick of 5,000 kilometers a second. And I've plotted up here on the right what this would look like for the typical masses and mass ratios you get from a star cluster. Now, typically speaking, your escape speed from a globular cluster is on order of 10 to 100 kilometers per second. Your kicks are all 1,000 kilometers a second. You're never, ever going to retain any of these merger products in the cluster. So that was sort of the story for a while, because we thought that all black holes had spins near 1, and so pretty much any time anything merged in the cluster, you wouldn't actually get to keep the remnant product around. And so a lot of us even wrote papers saying what we would be able to do with different spin distributions to tell the difference between dynamical and field population scenarios. I pointed out at some point that half the time you would expect the spins of black holes from star clusters to be anti-aligned with the orbits, and then the FARs in two separate papers, and in one case, both FARs in one paper, took that idea and ran with it and showed how many detections you would need to actually isolate dynamical versus field formation scenarios. Unfortunately, the more events we get, it looks like there's a slight conspiracy to produce events with near-zero chi effective. Chi effective, remember, is that parameter that Chris and people were talking about yesterday. It's just the mass-weighted projections of the spins onto the orbital angular momentum. And all but two of the LIGO-Virgo events are consistent with black holes having zero spin. And even the ones that aren't exactly near-extremal Kerr. They're, you know, about a little less than 0.2 and about 0.35. And so that could be because of two reasons. Because you're projecting the spins onto the orbital angular momentum, this could be a result of the fact that all the spins are just lying in the plane. Or it could just be that maybe black holes are actually born with low spins. Maybe, as people have been talking about, every time you collapse a star to form a black hole, it just doesn't actually transport most of that angular momentum into the remnant. In that case, we revisit this picture, and if I get rid of the spins, suddenly the gravitational wave emission is completely isotropic around the sphere. So my kicks essentially go to zero. And if I take the same population and I ask what happens if the spins are zero, suddenly this distribution shifts to much, much lower recoil velocities. And I can retain something like 50% of the merger products of binary black holes inside the star cluster. So now I have this new black hole with nearly twice the mass of the black holes that created it, and it's hanging out again in the center of a dense star cluster. Once it's there, it can undergo this three-body binary formation again, find itself a new partner, and potentially merge again. And so that's what I mean by the next generation of black holes, forging a second generation of black holes through repeated mergers that can then be detected by LIGO, Virgo, and other instruments. So the nomenclature that we tend to use for this, I straight up stole from a paper from a couple of papers. One was by Davide Girosa and Emanuele Berti. The other was by Maya Fischbach, Dan Holtz, and Ben Farr. And basically, we refer to these black holes by their generation. Stellar-born black holes, those created from the collapse of stars, we typically call 1G. The big ones that have merged once and will then merge again, we call 2G black holes. And then the way we refer to these binaries is just by the generations of their components. So in this case, I have a 1G black hole that is bound to a 2G black hole, so we call that 1G plus 2G. And so what I've been working on for the past couple of months is, as a function of the birth spins, exactly what fraction of the population from clusters would you expect to be second-generation mergers, and what fraction of those would you expect to see in the mass gap? So taking a series of about 100 or so dynamical models of dense star clusters, these are, by the way, much bigger than the ones that Mikola was talking about earlier. We're talking of a couple of million stars at the largest, real classical globular clusters. And convolving that with a cosmological model for star cluster formation, we can actually make detailed population estimates of how many 2G black holes you expect and how many of those will be in the pulsational parent stability gap. And so what I'm showing here is the fraction of sources that would be created in globular clusters and similar type clusters that are 1G plus 2G binary black holes. And I'm showing it as a function of the birth spin that we assign to every black hole formed from the collapse of a massive star. And so in the case where all stars are born non-spinning, going back to Jim Fuller's work, you can actually have about 13% of all binary black hole mergers have at least one component created in a previous merger. As I dial up the spins, as you would expect, we suddenly get fewer and fewer of those 2G black holes are retained, the number of merger products significantly decreases, and by the time we get to a spin of 0.5, we're talking less than 1% of binary black holes are going to have a 2G component. What about 2G plus 2G? So instead of 80 plus 40, what about 80 plus 80 solar mass black holes? In that case, it turns out you have much, much lower fractions. Only about 1% of mergers are 2G plus 2G, even if the stars are born non-spinning. And once you get past about a birth spin of 0.2, you basically don't retain enough 2G black holes to form any 2G plus 2G mergers. This is, of course, the astrophysical population. I can also convolve this with the LIGO-Virgo sensitivity and that cosmological model for star formation I was talking about and show what this looks like in terms of the detected distribution. And if I do that, these lines all bump up, as you would expect, because the 2G black holes are much more massive than the 1G black holes, so you're sensitive to a much larger volume of space-time. And in this case, about 20% of all mergers from globular clusters would have at least one component that was produced in a previous merger, of the population detectable by LIGO-Virgo, to be precise. And of those, about 7% would have at least one component greater than 55 solar masses, so something definitively in the mass gap. We can, of course, make predictions for what this looks like in terms of the total mass of the mergers. So on the left, I'm showing the distribution of total masses from an effective cosmological population of globular clusters. Overall redshifts. On the right, I've convolved it again with the LIGO-Virgo sensitivity function to produce what the detected distribution here on Earth at the present day would be. And so right now I'm showing just all binary black holes. We can, of course, divvy this up into different populations. So the 1G binary black, 1G plus 1G, typically inhibit the 20 to 80 solar mass range. There's a few things slightly higher than that that actually come from those repeated mergers of massive stars that Mikola was talking about. The 2G plus 1G black holes, suddenly push up to much higher masses. And suddenly now you're producing an entire second peak with 100, 120, maybe even up to 140 solar masses. And if I look at the 2G plus 2G black holes, you know, all the way up from here, all the way up to these absurdly large things with a total mass of 160 solar masses. This, of course, assumes a birth spin of zero for all the stars, so I'm retaining a large fraction of the binary black holes that merge from stars. As I dial that up, these distributions go down, and suddenly I'm producing virtually nothing above the pulsational parent stability gap. And in fact, when the spins of stars are 0.5, the majority of things I'm producing in the pulsational parent stability gap are actually coming from mergers of stars that then go on to produce things in the mass gap, the thing that Michaela was talking about earlier. The other nice thing about this is that regardless of the birth spins, this process produces black holes with detectable spins. So even if every black hole from a star is born with zero spin, you will still produce a significant spinning population from repeated mergers. And that's just because whenever I have two black holes merged together, you essentially convert all of that orbital angular momentum from the binary into the spin of the remnant. And so even if every black hole from a star is born with zero spin, this is showing the cumulative distribution of spins greater than a minimum chi effective, even in this case, you're still going to get a significant fraction of sources that are observable by LIGO-Virgo with spins. As I dial up the spins, that contribution from the second generation goes down, but the first generation contribution, so the black holes from stars, the black holes formed from stars, suddenly overtakes it. Until I dial it all the way up to 0.5, I essentially get no 2G black holes, and I'm basically just recovering the spin that I put in there. If I plop the LIGO-Virgo distribution on top of that, it is kind of unhelpful, but I think with a slightly better Bayesian analysis, this will start to improve. Now, we weren't the first people to think about this or even look at doing a proper Bayesian model selection process of this. In fact, going back to this, one of the first papers on this was actually by Davide Girossi and Emanuele Berti, and they actually showed, using these triangular plots, basically what fraction of the population could come from 1G1G plus, or 1G2G or 2G2G. And they actually just asked the question, how many detections would you need to start to constrain the fraction like they've done here? I'm not going to go into too much detail about this. And there was also another, like I said, a paper by Mai Fischbach, Dan Holtz, and Ben Farr that came out that looks at this question again. But the nice thing about this is because these black holes in the mass gap are distinctive, we can at least use it as a handle on dynamical formation as a process that operates in the universe. Of course, the caveat to that is that this does not necessarily imply that these things came from a globular cluster, because as we've talked about, you have plenty of other ways of forming these multiple mergers. And so for the last couple of minutes, I'm just going to break this down into sort of all of the dynamical ways you could produce these things, and I'm going to do it as a function of the escape speed of the cluster. So I've already talked about globular clusters. They tend to have escape speeds of maybe maybe 10 to 100 kilometers a second. Open clusters are much tinier than that. They tend to be about 1 to 10 kilometers a second. So you're not really going to be able to retain black hole mergers there, but you can retain stellar mergers. This is the exact same plot from Michaela's talk earlier. You can also go in the other direction and start moving towards nuclear star clusters, these things that hang out in the centers of most galaxies without critically a central massive black hole. This is from a paper by Fabio Antonini and Fred Brazio, basically showing that you can build up multiple generations of black holes. So whereas in clusters you can really only retain 2G black holes, anything greater than that gets kicked out, in nuclear star clusters with their escape speeds of 100, maybe even 1,000 kilometers a second, you can suddenly go up to 2G or 3G binary black hole mergers. And then finally, for the last minute or so, I'm just going to talk about AGNs, which is by far, I think, one of the things that has not gotten talked enough about at this workshop. So in the center of an AGN, you have a velocity dispersion and escape speed of a few even 10,000 kilometers to 10,000s of kilometers a second. Now, this channel is essentially a souped-up version of planetesimal migration through a disk. It's basically the answer to, what if I took protoplanetary migration through a disk, multiplied it by 10 to the 6, replaced the protostar with a supermassive black hole, and replaced the planetesimals with little black holeitesimals, essentially stellar mass black holes that have been ground down into the disk and get caught in the same resonance traps. Now, a lot of people have been looking at this since after the first LIGO detection. A couple of them are in this room. And just this morning on the archive, a new paper came out from Yang et al. That basically showed that because the escape speeds from right next to your AGN are so ridiculously large, you can build up many successive generations of black hole mergers. You can get up to maybe even 5 or 6 G binary black hole mergers. And because those black holes tend to align themselves with the disk, you actually get preferred magnitudes for chi effective. And so with that, I'm just going to leave this up here. I'm just sort of showing the dynamical landscape in terms of escape speed. And thanks so much for inviting me out.
Questions?
I have several questions, but I don't want to take over the whole discussion session, so I'll just ask a few. So one of the main things that worries me is so at some point you had a slide showing that if you take Kimax exactly equal to zero, you get a fraction of about 20% and 7% of exactly that.
Yeah.
So I'm a little worried about this because in the paper that we just did with Davide, we took a uniform distribution in Spain's up to a maximum chi for the components. And the only case where the low peak in the recoil distribution really pops up is when you take chi max to be exactly equal to zero. So if you have a distribution, understand that here you have taken chi to be some fixed number and then you...
Yeah, okay, so here we didn't want to muck around with the distribution. We wanted to keep it as simple as possible so we could, you know, hand Waverly-Greens function things into more complicated distributions later. So the chi berth along the bottom is a delta function, essentially. So for the chi berth of 0.1 models, every black hole from a star gets a spin of 0.1 identically. And you're right, these numbers do decrease pretty dramatically as a function of berth spin. I think part of the reason we get a higher retention fraction than your recent paper with Davide is that a lot of our retention is actually, well, so there's two reasons. One is that through dynamics, right, you're preferentially going to exchange partners during these encounters until you essentially get to equal mass. And if you have equal mass non-spinning binary black hole mergers, you get no recoil kick at all. It's identically zero. And so you're preferentially going to eliminate the mass ratio kick. The spin kick is a little more complicated. And once you get up, again, past about 0.2, your retention goes down significantly. I think part of the reason we're retaining more objects than you do, though, is just because we're looking at very massive clusters, things that start off with 1 or 2 million stars. And if you're asking what is the escape speed from the center of those clusters before they've lost all of their mass, so very early in their lifetime and when they're still very compact, you can get answers as up to 100 kilometers a second or maybe even a little bit higher.
Like I said, I don't want to take over, but there's one more comment that I do want to make. Doug Lane gave a very nice talk last week about formation in AGN disks. And one of the points that he made was that the spin alignment for the binaries that you form in AGN disks is complicated. Mm-hmm. And so the last slide that you showed from the paper by Yang et al., I think there they assume that the spins are either aligned or anti-aligned.
Yeah. So I'll fully admit that this paper came out on the archive this morning, so I grabbed the plots and haven't read it yet. I had to also prepare the rest of the talk. I think the chi effective distribution I'm a little more confused by. Like, I don't actually know how you converge to this unless you're somehow torquing the binaries in the disk. I'm sure Doug would probably know better. The mass part, though, I think is pretty hard to get around. The other nice thing is, and I didn't mention this at all, you basically preferentially, the magnitude of your kick depends on the spin vector. But the final spin of your black hole also depends on the orientation of the spin vectors. And so you're going to get lower kicks that more easily fall back into those resonance traps for particular regions of the spin parameter space. So you're actually going to exclude certain regions of the final spin magnitude space just by the fact that you need to keep these things back in the disk and back in the cluster.
I only want to make one last comment and then I'll shut up. The left panel of this plot, I know I'm commenting on a paper that is not even yours, but I read it last week.
Yeah, you actually read it. I haven't read it yet.
So what they have on the left panel is what we will call 1G plus NG. Mm-hmm. And they say in the paper that they're ignoring 2G plus 2G, and it's unclear to me why they do that. Mm. So I just want to make it.
Hi.
So you mentioned the importance of understanding that as binaries interact, their eccentricity changes, and this can make a big difference in terms of the rates. Mm-hmm. I think it's useful to remember that this has been known for decades, and people have incorporated in their simulations for a long time. So this is not a new insight, but I think the contributions you and Johan and many others have made has been in scale, fast, efficient codes, large-scale simulations, really filling in a lot of the details. But the basic physics of this has been known for a very long time.
Oh, right. And to give credit, the basic physics was worked out by you in the early 2000s with Ham.
And others as well.
I think what we've done here that's a little more... I think the push forward that we made here is the fact that we can do this in large clusters of several million stars and then convolve that onto a cosmologically reasonable sort of model for star cluster formation. But again, like I said, this dynamics has been well understood since, hell, Quinlan and Shapiro was written before I was born. So, I mean, it's been around for a while.
Carl, could you comment on implications on black hole spins and the neutron star black hole context? Have you thought about that at all?
So black hole neutron stars are extremely difficult to form in these models in that, believe me, try as I might, I cannot cook up any good dynamical way to create black hole neutron star or neutron star mergers. Not just in clusters, but in just about anything. It turns out to be very difficult in just about every formation channel. It might be doable in AGN disks. I haven't poked at that. Or it might be difficult, doable, I'm guessing, in open clusters because Michaela is raising her hand. But at least in the dense star clusters that I've looked at, it just seems to be virtually undoable.
Okay, I have a question following on the Emanuele and Cole question. What's the primordial fraction of binaries in initial fraction of binaries in your models? Low?
Yeah,
zero?
So we did 10%, which is fairly standard to reproduce the present day observed things.
Sure. So if that will have impact on your attention fraction, of course, if you. Mm-hmm. Make the traction higher, eccentricity would be lower of emerging systems because it won't be there will be a lot of binaries that form from primordial binaries.
Yeah.
And this needs to be lower, so retention fraction would go down, is it right?
Oh, it would go down. I would assume it would go up. Just because you have more binaries initially and they're all going to merge.
No, but they will live longer so they can get kicked out faster out of a cluster.
Typically, no, actually. So if you have a post-common envelope binary, it's going to be so hard after the envelope that it's essentially going to dynamically decouple from the rest of the cluster. So it's most likely, at least in the simulations we're looking at, it's going to merge before it actually has a binary single encounter.
I would like to see the simulation with 50% binaries and see the effect.
Yeah, I think that would have some really cool effects. It would also really let you start playing around with these ideas that maybe a lot of massive binaries just merge before they even collapse down to black holes, not even through dynamical encounters, but just as isolated binary evolution. And that could be a really interesting way to sort of produce a very massive population.
Carl, So I think LIGO can see something like 400 solar mass merge or something, so its sensitivity goes up a bit higher. Is there a mass that LIGO could detect that you collectively, as theorists, would say, nope, there's no way we can sort of explain through these channels? Or would it be like, oh, it's an 8G or 9G, you know, AGN? Like, is there some point where you would throw your hands up?
Well, so at least from the models of classical globular clusters, you can't really get above about 100, about 2G plus 2G. So you can't really retain 2G, 1G mergers or 2G, 2G mergers in the cluster just because the kicks they get are several hundred kilometers a second. If you want to get up to the 400 plus 400 range, I think you either need a nuclear star cluster or you need an AGN disk. I think that's really the only ways to start getting up into those mass rate regimes.
Or is Felix said to just increase IMF to 200 or 500 or 600 solar masses?
Yeah, no, I guess you could just skip the pulsational periodicity gap entirely. So
what is the velocity distribution that you use in these clusters? Is it like flat or is it peaked in a cluster really? Do you only take into account black holes that are kicked out from the merger recoil or also birth recoils or stuff like that?
So to answer your first question, we essentially take an initial distribution that's drawn from a King model, which is just an isothermal in energy with a cutoff given by the tidal field of the galaxy, and the clusters roughly stay pretty close to that. As for what can kick out the black holes, you can have initial natal kicks. So we use the same the same supernova natal kick prescriptions that the Chris's have developed, Chris Belchinsky and Chris Breyer. So you can kick them out through natal kicks. You can kick them out through dynamics. So binary just gets a large recoil during one of these Newtonian encounters, and that throws it out of the cluster. Or you can kick it out by gravitational wave recoil kicks.
Well, it's more like two comments, one for your questions on neutron stars. I think here is also not only the difference between open cluster and globular clusters, but also the difference between a Monte Carlo approach and a direct embodied approach. So maybe we should run more comparison sample. Actually, in our simulations, and I think the same should happen also in globular cluster, what we find is that the dynamical effect on the formation of binary neutron stars and black hole neutron stars is more related to the interactions of their progenitors. So the double neutron stars that form by exchange, we have some of them, we are going to publish them soon. It's not an exchange involving two neutron stars, but it's an exchange involving their progenitors, because the progenitors of two neutron stars are much more massive than two neutron stars. So they are more likely to form that, to have exchanges and lead to the dynamical formation of binary neutron stars. This is even more effective for black hole neutron stars. And the second thing that I wanted to comment on was about the two black holes, both of 400 solar masses. I think here is very important the way we describe the runaway collision scenario. So not the collision of several black holes with each other, but the fast collision of several massive stars at the beginning, really at the beginning of the life of the star clusters in the first few million years. And some early work, I think by Mark Freitag, he's not even an astrophysicist anymore, showed that it's possible to have more than one runaway collision product in the same globular cluster, and they may pair in a binary. And I think this, we really need to work more on this, because I'm talking about papers of 2005, 2006, something like that.
Yeah, the problem is we know about as much. Well, I mean, we still don't really know like what happens to these massive things when you have this runaway. Anyway, do you end up with just a sort of giant common envelope bag of cores like Melvin Davis has been said for a while, or does it actually like settle down into a single star? And then what do the winds look like from that?
Well, now we have much better stellar evolution codes to study them. So I think it's something. We have a better understanding of stellar winds and everything. We have new hydro simulations of star collisions. So I think it's about the right time to study this.
Okay, let us, thanks again, Carl. And all the speakers of the morning, and please continue your discussion during the coffee.